Well, I'm excited to be joined by author, explorer, researcher, Hugh Newman. Hugh, thanks for joining me again on Megalithic Marvels.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Man, it's hard to keep up with you. You're always traveling the world. It seems like every time I look at your Instagram or YouTube, you're somewhere else. Tell us about your latest travels real quick and any exciting projects you're looking forward to.
So in late December, me and JJ Ainsworth, along with Andrew Collins and a couple of friends in Turkey, we went to Karahan Tepe specifically to have another look and record and observe the winter solstice sunrise alignment that me and JJ discovered the year before we went there. And we were lucky, the weather was brilliant. And we got to see three mornings of the light coming through the porthole stone, illuminating the head of this 11,400-year-old site. So that was the big thing we've been focusing on and continue to focus on, actually. We're writing more and more about this. We've had a big article came out about this, before this solstice. We put it up on Graham Hancock's website. He was very kind. He really liked what we'd done. And obviously that Karahan Tepe and Göbekli Tepe featured quite prominently in his brilliant Netflix show Ancient Apocalypse as well, so we were kind of delighted it all kind of linked together. And since then we're just focusing on writing and prepping for some tours and conferences and everything else we've got planned for 2023.
That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely want to start out talking about Karahan Tepe. I watched one of your latest videos about it. It was great. For people who might not be totally aware of this amazing site like you are, can you give us a little background into kind of when and how it really began to be discovered? And then how it relates to Göbekli Tepe.
Sure. Well, Karahan Tepe it goes back to 11,400 years old, or 9,400 BC. It's the oldest date they've got on it. But we're visiting there for many years before it was excavated. So you were seeing these kind of little T-pillars sticking out of the ground, and there was an unfinished 18-foot monolith still in the quarry part of the site over on the west. And we kind of knew something major was going to be found there. I mean, I've been going there since like 2014 or something. And it was only in 2019 it began to be excavated by the Istanbul archaeology team. And what they found already, only a very small amount of the site has been found, is absolutely mind-blowing. It's on par with Göbekli Tepe, and even that site is only a few hundred years older and potentially slightly bigger. And we're finding the massive T-pillars, we're finding bedrock, you know, carved solid out of solid bedrock, hypogeum type, kind of underground or kind of pits and things like this. Huge enclosure, larger than anything at Göbekli Tepe, with potentially 18 T-pillars in the perimeter. It's like a elliptical oval shape, 75 feet wide. On the western side, it's really interesting, about five of the T-pillars. It's almost like they have, you know, several freestanding T-pillars. Then they start blending into the bedrock, and they're literally carved directly out of the bedrock and as the hill rises up on the western side. And so you've got a remarkable series of features there, which are unique. The AB pit, or the pillar shrine, it's like a 7 by 6 meter really interesting sunken pit carved out of bedrock with these bedrock pillars sticking up. They look kind of phallic. They look like mushrooms. They're very odd. And then there's a freestanding pillar, which is like almost like a rising serpent. And then there's a head sticking out of the western edge with this intense look on its face with like serpentine scales on its neck. And that's what gets illuminated on the winter solstice around December the 21st. It still works today. It probably worked better, you know, 9,400 BC. That's what we've realized. It probably would have been a slightly lower angle, so a slightly better illumination of the head. And it kind of moves around the head. Starts over here, moves around the head over about, well, now we've worked out it's about 45 minutes, and it starts around 10 minutes after sunrise. In our article, we weren't sure because we didn't catch all the sunrise the previous year. So we're going to update everything and publish it all in articles and on the video coming out soon. So yeah, but Karahan Tepe, it's just tip of the iceberg. Leshmi Karal, the head archaeologist, says only 1% has been uncovered, and they're realizing it stretches over this huge area.
Only 1% they think has been uncovered. That's incredible. so many questions I've got for you about this site. And on the podcast, I'm going to link to your YouTube video. Everybody's got to go watch that because you've just got some amazing drone footage of the site. And then this face. So there's this one enclosure that's got the famous face that you photographed and these other pillars sticking up. So you're saying this face has like serpentine features going down the neck? Because, I mean, if this thing's 11,400 years old, I mean, this face is still, it's so well preserved still. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's about three times the size of like my head, for instance. It's got a flat top. It's got like this almost like a speaking mouth. And the eye is interesting. Neshmi Karel pointed this out, that they look towards the right. It's right. Towards the porthole stone, where where there's this gap, you know, which the sunlight comes through. So clearly, and that's kind of carved out of bedrock as well. This hole in the stone. It's like it's very odd. And what happened was, and there's been a paper published by Neshmi Karel on this, is the fact that they deliberately filled it all in specific layers of soil and debris and rock, and then they're quite large slabs on top. So it was all preserved. Everything was preserved almost as it was when they decided to cover it over, probably around 8,000 BC. And so that's why it's been preserved. But if you look in the main enclosure, most of the stuff, most of the T-pillars, everything's quite badly damaged. It's almost like they deliberately decommissioned, damaged the site before they then covered that over as well. And now most of the site is still covered over. But it was the same at Göbekli Tepe, same kind of principles. And so that in its own right is a huge amount of work and must have been traditional, must have been a thing they did way back then.
So that had to be quite, I mean, to me, this seems like a fairly incredible discovery. And you're saying, I think you and JJ made the discovery where with the solstice, where the light goes through what you call the portal stone and actually hits that face. How did you kind of give us the backstory of how you discovered this? Because to me, this is incredible.
Yeah, well, we were there last year, 2021. We were there in December because we hadn't been since it had been excavated. It was our first chance to go. So we went. We drove a lot. We were all along the south coast, you know, doing huge amounts of driving, this, that, and the other. And we went to see Karahan Tepe. I popped up there to see because I know the family there. I've known them since 2014. Andrew Collins has been going there even longer than that, and we kind of got to know them and everything over the years, having tea and lunch with them whenever we visit and stuff like this. So I was kind of popped up there to visit them just to have a look, you know. And then JJ, we were going to go the next day for a full day visit kind of thing. But then I got a call from the family member Ishmael, and he said, oh, by the way, all the officials are coming in tomorrow and they're going to cover it over because of the extreme bad weather, because it was horrific rain and wind and light thunder and things like this were taking place for a couple of weeks. And we were like, oh god, you know. So we thought we better get there first thing, just get there as early as possible to make sure they don't cover it over before we see it, kind of thing. And we kind of had a sense there was going to be something there because we knew about something Andrew Collins had discovered, this summer solstice sunset alignment over a different enclosure, which is like the sunken subterranean pit, and the unfinished pit is called. And so the opposite of the summer solstice sunset is the winter solstice sunrise, if you're looking at it kind of on a map. That's how it works. And so we thought, well, maybe there's something there. Let's go and check it out. And that's when we witnessed it. We witnessed suddenly this head was being illuminated. We were like, what the hell? This was like, we got there about half an hour after sunrise because of it was cloudy for a while. So we had to wait for the clouds to clear, and we got there a few minutes late. But then we saw it and it kind of moved around the head. This was me and JJ kind of just freaking out. We were like, what the hell? This is, you know, and obviously no one had seen it before because they'd only uncovered it properly within the last year before we were there. So no one would have seen it anyway, even if they were looking before that particular day. And then they covered it all over. So no one else could go there and witness it. This was on the 20th of December. And so, yeah, so we realized this is quite a major thing. We wrote about it. We published on it, put videos out on it. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't believe it or something. They can't believe it's a real thing. They're claiming there's a roof over it, so it wouldn't have seen it. Or they're claiming, oh, well, it doesn't work. It wouldn't have worked 11,400 years ago because of obliquity, because of precession. But we checked all that, and it's only less than a degree difference. And actually, it might have improved it, we've worked out. It might have been a better illumination even back then. And so, yeah, we're pretty convinced that they were marking the winter solstice, and this was part of their ceremonial. It was part of their practical agricultural kind of revolution, which was just beginning at this time. It's like these sites were built, and then the agricultural revolution, farming, animal domestication, all this stuff took force and went ballistic. And we think that there's more to it than that. You know, I've got a good sense, and there's been some evidence emerged from Göbekli Tepe that they were working with magnetism, and this would enhance the seeds and grains. And they were doing ceremonies to start with to do this, and they realized that there's something about the geology, the magnetism in the earth and stuff like this. And so this is why they were choosing these specific spots to build these sites. And we know now that there were many of these sites. It's called the whole Testepala region. And there's like officially 12, but potentially many more, all of a similar design and style. And remarkable things are now coming out of the ground because they're excavating all of them slowly over the next few years.
I've seen other video and photos of some, I think they've been pulled out of the same site. Basically really defined faces, statue faces. I don't know the name of it, but there's one that's just got this amazing, like big brow lines on the head and this, you know, kind of squarish mouth. Did that come from the same site? And is there anything you know about it?
Yeah, that's one of the that's one of the famous statues that came out of Karahan Tepe. Yeah, that's one of the many. There's a good, really cool room display now at Shanlurfa Museum, which is the local town to Karahan Tepe and Göbekli Tepe. And there's remarkable statues are being found, really beautifully carved pieces. The head you're talking about was found embedded in one of the walls, and it's got like these big frown lines, it looks like, on it, and really elongated at the back. So people are questioning, is that representing an elongated headed person? Others suggest it's actually a mask, a representation of a mask, which is, we know they were using, they had stone masks have been found there, small and large ones. And also the head, they say, could be a hood, could be where the hair collected at the back. Who knows? I mean, but this was obviously part of a much larger statue, even though it's only one small, it's pretty big. It's like this wide and this thin kind of thing. And it's one of many. I mean, there's more artifacts there. There's beautiful, beautiful pieces carved out that are very small. And remember, none of this is really pottery. This is pre-pottery Neolithic era officially. So this is all carved out of stone. Then there's these quite large stone plates, which are carved of all these different types of stone, some of them extremely hard stone, like possibly diorite and other things, different types of granite. These were found around the benches, around the main enclosure on the benches. And these are like something you find in Egypt, like beautifully polished, you know, really hard stone. So how on earth were they shaping and polishing stone 11,400 years ago? This is one of the big, big question marks, along with these really abstract, odd statues like the one you mentioned.
So you said the stone here is what again?
Well, there's different types of stone they found. I mean, the main stone of the site is limestone. It's a limestone plateau. It's different qualities through different regions. There's a basalt outcrop a few miles away. So some of the basalt plates were made from could have been from there. But generally, there's nothing else. It's just limestone. Really, really, some of it's really fine limestone. Some of it's a bit more, got more holes in it.
So this one enclosure that's got the face and these other mysterious pillars, what do you think was originally happening in this chamber? Was it mostly a ceremonial chamber, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's more ceremonial than anything else. I mean, it's clearly got water going on with it. There's channels leading into it. There's obviously got the hole which the light comes through on the winter solstice. Doesn't work any other time of year, by the way. It just works on the winter solstice. And there were kind of very faded steps going down into it through the hole. So there may have been some kind of ceremony talked a lot of trying to work this out with JJ and Andrew Collins about what we think was going on. It's like they were going through, because all these three enclosures, the main 75 foot wide, almost like stone circle type enclosure, AD, I think, joining enclosure AB, the pillar shrine, then joins up to the next enclosure, the sunken area as well, where it appears to be unfinished, which I think contained water. And so these are all kind of joined together as though there's some kind of process that must have took place, potentially, you know, winter solstice fertility ceremonies, because the main enclosure is big enough to have major dances and events. There's big seats, like thrones carved out of solid bedrock facing east, so facing the sunrise. But remember, this is just what's been uncovered so far, so no doubt more will come out and the story will become more clear.
Tell us about the serpent-like pillar that's in the enclosure. And you mentioned in your video the oral traditions of, I think, Enki, the Sumerian god, and a possible connection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, if you look into the different traditions, I mean, you've got, like, I talk mainly about the head, the stone head and the serpentine neck on it. But there's also another stone, which is like a freestanding pillar, because the rest are carved out of bedrock, which is slightly curved. It's almost look like it's got an eye on it. So it looks like a bit of a serpent. JJ's convinced it's representing a serpent coming up. Other people say, Martin Sweatman suggests it's like half a large oval kind of porthole stone. That's half that's left. And that was balanced there, like the T-pillars are balanced in the main enclosure, kind of just in this small socket in the ground. But the whole thing, I mean, if you look into the myths of Enki and Enlil, the traditional stories of the Sumerians specifically, not Zechariah Sitchin stuff or anything like that, but the translations I've been reading are from Christian O'Brien and the Genius of the Few and the Shining Ones books that came out in the 80s. And if you look into these myths of Enki and Enlil and so forth, they talk about this virility, this fertility, and often there's lots of kind of sexual or kind of that kind of thing mentioned. It appears to sound like that, but these are like gods we're talking about here, and they would fertilize the land with their seed and all this kind of stuff. And they were often represented as the serpent people. And then you have the goddess Ninhasag or Ninlil. That's one of the primary kind of seven sages, seven gods and goddesses of ancient Sumeria. And these were, and you start reading all these stories and all these myths, and they all kind of fit with what you can see at places like Karahan Tepe and Göbekli Tepe. I mean, I know Andrew Collins has made the connection between this area and those stories before. And I think there's definitely something in that. And I think, you know, we've got a second article coming out on Graham Hancock's website. We're taking our time with it because it's going to be part of a book we're going to do in the future. And there's remarkable amount of evidence that connects this to goddess traditions. If you know the work of Maria Gimbutas, it's something JJ's does a huge amount of research on. She's studied all her work. And she's, and all the symbology, all the different styles and everything else are linked with this fertilizing goddess principle, which is found throughout Europe, going back to the Mesolithic, to the similar era to Karahan Tepe. And this is also found here. So this is maybe where it all originated, these goddess traditions, these fertility rites, even the stories of Enlil and Enki, because even in them stories, they clearly talk about the creation of farming. They talk about how it all began after they built some temples, after they built their kind of great house, their home called Karsag, inside the Garden of Eden, and so on and so forth. And so it all kind of fits. Everything in these old stories is starting to make sense with all the new discoveries that are coming out.
And one of the pillars you pointed out in your video, in the ceremonial enclosure, I believe, has what looks like eight fingers on a hand, right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a weird one, actually. Yeah, my buddy Dakota Wint, he pointed that out to me, actually. And it's odd. I mean, this is like a square enclosure with curved corners. And it's got four pillars in the kind of square inside it with this beautiful kind of floor made out of solid, very large slabs of stone, all neatly placed together. But the pillar, the one standing T-pillar, it's one of the classic T-pillars, the head's broken off it, with the hands touching the navel, like a garment, almost like a shirt like this going down, carved in the rock, with a V-neck as well. And the hands look like there's eight fingers on each hand. And so this is weird in itself. But then Neshmi Kharal stated in one of his papers or one of his lectures that he's the main archaeologist, that all the statues that are being found don't have the correct amount of fingers or toes and things like this at Karahan Tepe, as though it's some kind of, could be some symbolic thing they were working with, or it could be, you know, polydactyly, extra fingers, extra toes, things like this, because we know there are reports of this kind of stuff going back into prehistory, especially when you start looking into the old stories again. They talk about, especially when it comes to giants, having extra fingers and toes.
So humor me for a minute. So we've got this pillar with eight fingers. We've got the face in the ceremonial enclosure that's got almost a serpentine neck. We've got the pillar with serpentine features. We've got that other statue head that was pulled out that might have an elongated skull. Put all these together, is there the possibility that this ancient civilization, some, you know, 11,000 years ago, was more than just humans?
You're kind of talking about kind of ancient alien stuff, possibly. Yeah,
I'm wondering hybrids, almost like maybe hybrids. We see it Paracas, Peru. You mentioned the other site in Malta, you know, that hypogeum. Elongated skulls were found there, almost like this was some kind of hybrid situation. Any thoughts on that here with Karahan Tepe?
Yeah, it's quite possible. Yeah, it's something that I know Andrew's really into. He's into this sort of Denisovan connection, hybrid connection coming down through Russia, Siberia, and so forth, through, you know, northern parts of Europe, Bosphorus and everything out, the Black Sea rather, and everything else like that. So it's quite possible. I mean, it seems like if you look at the old stories, the old Sumerian traditions, the old kind of texts that were carved, remembered in Sumeria, in the tablets and so forth, they do talk about this, that they created humans. I know this sounds odd, but this is where Zachariah Sitchin got a lot of his ideas from. But if you look at the original texts, the original translations, they, you know, Ninhasag was involved in it, Enlil, Enki, all of them in different stories, vary slightly, that they created humans from blood and clay in the ground. And so it seems like they were referencing some kind of hybridization going on, you know, so that may well have been the case. And then if you look into the whole biblical, you know, and the biblical Nephilim and so forth, yeah, and also the Book of Enoch and the Watchers and so forth, which are pretty much the same as the Anunnaki, who are the Enlil and Enki were all part of the Sumerian tradition as well. So they all talk about this. They all talk about these strange beings who are almost like semi-divine, and also about creating a different race of beings as well from clay and blood and things like this. And so what does all that mean? I mean, when you actually translate it and read it, it's really hard to, you know, could they really have been doing this back then? Is this a reality, or is this just symbolic of their kind of creation stories and myths? So the jury's out on that. But when you start, you know, until we get actual samples of bones and things like that, we're not going to know too much.
So this site, obviously, it's similar to Göbekli Tepe in that it's in the same region. It's got these similar T-pillars. Yet, as you point out, it is different in ways. Do you think this was just like literally a sister site or cousin site, and it's a little different just because it was a little further away, or anything else to speak into that point of the similarities but the differences?
Yes, yeah, sure. This one is more remote. It's like not got, there's no water sources near it at all, and miles away. So they were collecting water. We know that. They were doing that at Göbekli Tepe now as well. They proved that there was water harvesting going on. but it's in the Tek Tek Mountains. And this is a very kind of remote, very dry, very unfertile area. So you can't really grow anything there. You've never really been able to grow much there. There's a few olive trees and pistachio farms and things like that, which use very thin soil, a small amount of soil on the surface, so you can grow that kind of stuff. But it's not, you know, you wouldn't have been growing fields of food around that as well, which you would have near a Göbekli Tepe. You would have been able to do that more. And the Göbekli Tepe, it appears like that was a few hundred years at least before Karahan Tepe. And the quality of the craftsmanship and the size and magnitude of the scale of it in total is absolutely stunning. Whereas Karahan Tepe seems a bit more slightly ruined, if you know what I mean. And although it's quite vast, I think, you know, there's a lot we don't know really until it's been properly excavated. That's the problem. But I think, it's known as the sister site to Göbekli Tepe. It's known as, it's got feminine connotations with the name of it as well. If you look into the name of it, it never used to be called Karahan Tepe. That was an invented name in 1997. It used to be called Keçli, which is Keçli Tepe, which is like, it means different things. I think in Turkish, it means something like bald or bald head. So this is the interesting thing with the head. It may have been a memory of that. If you go into the different Kurdish, different types of Northern Kurdish and things like this, Andrew had a good look at this and he found some really interesting things to do with what KEC, Keck, means. And this is the original name. This is what it always was called before it was excavated, before it was discovered in 1997. And it can mean female, woman, daughter, maiden, even queen, or even goddess. And so it may have been a feminine site originally. It may have been its primary purpose, whereas Göbekli Tepe may have been more of a male-dominated site because that was the accumulation over thousands of years of hunters, you know, and probably like a more patriarchal kind of group forming society there, because there's very few female objects and carvings found at Göbekli Tepe, where there's more evidence, it appears, until, you know, that the symbolism which suggests it's more feminine, as well as the original name.
One more question about this site. Why do you think it's the biggest discovery of the 21st century, and how is this rewriting the mainstream version of history?
Yeah, I think it's the biggest story come out of archaeology and since Göbekli Tepe. To be frank, you know, that's the way it is. It's just the age of it is outrageous. It's on par with Göbekli Tepe with the style and everything like this. The stone carving technologies, the fact now it's got a winter solstice, very accurate alignment, means that this is the first site they've found anything like this. You know, they haven't really found that 100% at Göbekli Tepe yet. There's lots of ideas about it. Andrew's got a very good theory. It's aligned to Cygnus, the stars. You know, there's the Sirius idea with it, other ones about Orion and so forth. But, you know, when you get looking in the solstices and the equinoxes, you can fix it. You know, you can kind of prove it. And this is what has happened at Karahan Tepe. But also, you're looking at some of the stone carving is quite different here. They're carving whole enclosures out of bedrock. So this is like, you know, Malta style, like hypogeum quality. This is where it must have all began. There's cut marks there. These are the first cut marks in the world. There's other parts of the site where they're leaving kind of tools and evidence in the quarry. You know, so they just had this really surprising understanding, and using this abstract artistic element, the symbology, and just all these different things, you just cannot believe this was just some simplistic hunter-gatherer society. It's almost like this high-level group just built it. It's like they must have had a process thousands of years leading up to this. They must have done, because you don't just create this out of nothing, this whole complex. And then you've got Göbekli Tepe, then you've got all these other sites, all with the same style, all across the region, potentially 12 sites officially, but possibly many more, up to 30 possibly. There's even older sites found up near the Tigris River, because these are all based near the Euphrates. And these are the two sacred rivers of the Garden of Eden that are talked about in the Book of Enoch, they're talked about in the Sumerian traditions, linked with the Anunnaki and everything else. And so the age of it is outrageous. We're now finding, you know, astronomy, we're finding possible, you know, working with natural magnetism to enhance seeds and grains. The abstract artistic forms, the geometry I've been looking at as well. I'm going to make a kind of announcement about that soon. It's going to come out in a video and in a book I'm working on. We found all these geometries at both of these sites, which no one has spotted before, which prove that they must have had a high understanding of not just measurements like metrology and things like this, but they must have measured the Earth by then. They must have had them because we're finding the measurement systems are ancient measurement systems, which are subdivisions of the Earth's shape and size. So this all fits in with the Book of Enoch. This is all he talks about, going off with the angels or the watchers and measuring the Earth, taking cords and going off to measure and things like this. So you got all these different things, you know, which prove this to me. I call it a super civilization. That's going to be what we're going to call the book probably. And because it is, it's the world's first civilization, the super civilization, and it stretches over a vast area long before the Sumerians, Egyptians, anything in Britain or anywhere else. And so, I look forward to seeing what continues to come out of the ground there.
Well, Hugh, this has been a great interview. Thank you so much for your time. How can people follow you, connect with you, and get involved with your latest projects?
Yes, sure. I mean, they can go to megalithomania.co.uk. They can search for Hugh Newman and my partner, JJ Ainsworth. If they want to connect up with us, they should come to our conference. We do that every May, early May in Glastonbury. We have some top speakers coming every year. We've got a whole bunch of them, Robin Heath, Irving Finkel, a whole bunch of people coming. We have some top archaeologists joining us as well. And we also do a few days of tours around the conference. And it's also online as well. We're going to send you a link for that as well, an online version so people can watch it from home, because this we kind of created it to create this bridge between academia and the alternative world, because we felt it was not being addressed. There's all this, you know, look at what's happening with Graham Hancock and Ancient Apocalypse. There's all this kind of back and forth negative energy being thrown around. But we also, you know, as you know, as you do as well, we run tours to many of these places like Göbekli Tepe. We go there a couple of times a year, Karahan Tepe. We do Orkney tours, Stonehenge tours and everything else. So people can check it all out on megalithomania.co.uk. And we're working hard on a couple of publications, which will hopefully be out. One of them will be out later this year and another one the next year.
Awesome. And to everybody listening or watching, make sure and subscribe to the Megalithomania YouTube channel. Great videos. He's always pumping out content. So he thanks again, man, and safe journeys out there in the world.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, D. I appreciate it, and I look forward to catching up again soon.